Eric.
Hello, Charles.
How are you doing, man?
I'm doing very well.
So we're in Building 99 again.
Yes.
And this is a rather really cool little room we're in.
Yeah, it's like the boardroom.
Excellent.
And today we have an interview that will make Mary Jo Foley completely jealous because we're talking with Gazelle people.
All right.
Yes, so that's Helen.
Hi.
And Alex.
Excellent. Hi.
So, Helen, can you tell us a little bit, you know, about yourself for the Niners?
I'm Helen Wang. I lead a security research group here in Building 99 as part of Microsoft Research Redmond division.
And so what is your background? Where were you before Microsoft?
I was a PhD student at UC Berkeley before Microsoft, and as soon as I got my PhD, I came here.
Nice.
So I've been to Microsoft for more than 7 years right now.
Okay. Good. And Alex?
And I've been working with Helen since October. Uh-huh. And I'm currently a PhD student at University of Washington,
Across the street here?
Yep.
Excellent.
Good. So, yeah, so, you know, I always ask, like, you know, researchers and also kind of product people, so what is kind of, you know, the biggest problem, you know, that you're facing, and what keeps you awake at night? You know, what's going to, you know, it's like, what gives you the cold sweat?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, are you working on that then?
Yes. Actually, what's giving me all the sweat is that, you know, today the world is migrating to, software as service or software plus service, where, you know, many users' computing needs can be just satisfied by, you know, web applications, web services, by, you know, services that are hosted on the cloud and, you know, being browsed by today's web browsers. And we all know that applications run on top of operating systems, and you ask the question, where do web applications run on? They are running on web browsers. But nevertheless, web browsers have never been designed and built as a operating system to support all these applications running on top of it. And, you know, the web platform actually has evolved over the past, you know, since 1995 or so, over the past, this, you know, how many years now? It's like almost 15 years. There has been, the web platform has undergone quite a bit of evolution. It's just the application that for you to view static documents, one document at a time. Today, you know, you go to different websites and there's dynamic content, whether it's JavaScript or whether it's, the plugin content, mm-hmm. such as content that uses Flash, the content that, you know, like Silverlight content and such. It's a very rich and dynamic web applications content out there that we're facing. And in fact, on this web browser platform today, what's actually sharing this browser as well as the underlying system resource is no longer the users who are using the computers, but it's the website. For example, you know, the content or dynamic content from Google.com should be completely isolated from Microsoft.com, as an example. Right. So these websites are actually the mutually trusting parties or principals that are running on this platform, and they ought to be protected from one another. And exactly, you know, the kind of role that an operating system has been providing to a lot of, you know, our today's desktop applications. The role of operating system is to offer the protection across the principles and is to provide the resource management, you know, for the principles. And that, you know, these aspects are completely lacking in today's browsers due to, it wasn't initially designed for this. Mm-hmm. And but people are catching on.
Yeah, so it's like one of the things, you know, like I'm a kind of an amateur web designer, you know. It's like like JavaScript, right? I mean, like, you know, when you are in the browser, your JavaScript kind of, you know, like all the instances are shared across all the things that, you know, so like one page can change the prototype of array and then that will affect all other pages. Is that kind of an example of where there's a lack of kind of isolation? Is that...
So the isolation is mostly, you know, you have JavaScript running for Google.com, and you have JavaScript running for Microsoft.com. And the JavaScript that runs for Google.com basically runs with the privilege of Google.com. And the ones that run on Microsoft.com runs with the privilege of Microsoft.com. And they are, because they are mutually distrusting principles, and they ought to be isolated. In today's browser, there is this... security policy called Safe Margin Policy, which is, you know, the, for example, the document content that belong to one origin cannot interfere with that of another origin. So this kind of a sort of vague principle concept actually has been existing in the browser world, but has not been well realized in the construction of the browser. For example, recently we have some more innovations in the browser space. For example, IE8 are doing, you know, process per tab, you know, isolating tabs from one another, and Google Chrome is also performing similar style isolation, but with some more isolation. It's more granular than IE8. But even in both scenarios, before IE8 and Google Chrome, you know, for all the previous versions of the browsers, and it's basically a monolithic browser architecture. So that is, you know, all the websites and all the functioning of browsers there contained within a single process.
So why is that? So why don't we just kind of, you know, expose all the things from the operating system to the browser, and that the browser is just like, you know, some window that contains the graphics, but, you know, it just, you use just the underlying operating system mechanisms?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? I think that's really how browser should have evolved. I think we are at the time of evolving the browser to be an operating system and to leverage the underlying operating system mechanisms, but tailor them for the special characteristics of applications. We are exactly at this crossroad, and this is exactly the approach that Gazelle is taking. And
okay, so that's interesting. So what, you know, because I've been kind of, you know, I was very fascinated by your paper, but what kind of, you know, the question that kept kind of, you know, spinning in my mind is like, you know, what exactly are the kind of differences between the browser and just kind of, you know, an operating system, kind of, you know, a normal operating system? So where is the kind of special differences?
Yes, I think a very interesting characteristic of the web application is that one application, one website, may be embedding content from a different principles or from a different website. So whenever I say principle here, I refer to a website.
Okay.
And that's our... So, for example, in today's desktop operating systems, a user is a principle. And in our Gazelle browser, we consider a website to be a principle. And in Gazelle browser, we build a browser-based operating system to manage these principles, website principles, just to be clear. So you asked a really good question. You know, what's so special about the web applications? I think a really interesting characteristic of web applications that has flourished over the past years is really this characteristic of service composition, cross-principle, cross-website service composition. You embed an ad, you know, that's from a different principle. You embed some other people's content, like a user profile, but that's actually a different principle from, say, your social networking website. There, this kind of rich cross-principle service composition poses interesting sharing of the resources, whether it's the display, whether it's the CPU, whether it's the memory, whether it's the, you know, so that's actually really what's...
Okay, and so would you say that in the kind of traditional kind of applications that run on the desktop, there's less composition, it's like more different monolithic applications that themselves are not composed out of smaller ones that kind of, you know...
It's not like composing principles that are, you know, they have their own independent identities. You know, in the traditional desktop application, you may possibly use other people's libraries, but you incorporate them explicitly into your coding, and that's a way of, you know, expressing a trust, you know, of that piece of code and using that as your own. Of course, sometimes that may lead to problems. And of course, you know, whoever incorporates those kind of libraries need to be careful. That kind of library incorporation in web application also exists. But what more is that you can't actually have two principles running at the same time and sharing the display and basically being presented to the user at the same time. And that's actually, it does not really, for example, in today's desktop world, right? You log in as Eric, and all these applications are yours, and most of them they run as your username, And in today's desktop operating system, user is a principal. They all understand. They all run under pretty much one.
Okay. And so,
right?
But in
the browser world, you go to a website. There are many principals involved, and they run as different principals simultaneously right in front of your face.
So can you kind of, you know, explain like what would be the danger of having like, you know, two principals kind of sharing the same kind of, you know, UI? What kind of tricks can the bad guys do with that?
Right. I think the most important thing, you know, they can I think more fundamentally, there are multiple principals running simultaneously and being presented to the user at the same time. First of all, they need to run in a separate protection domains. Then consequently, you also need to solve the problem. If they run in separate protection domains, say separate processes, then you need to deal with how are you going to arbitrate the display as well, because you know one should not be able to draw over the other, right? So in fact, in our technical report, the Gazelle technical report, we actually basically gave a very good design on the display management, display sharing. And the interesting thing is that you have a web page, you maybe embed another website, right? And we call that, you know, this alter web page, we call that, you know, the landlord.
Okay.
It's a landlord principle. And in fact, it's almost like renting a part of your display, renting it to a tenant. Then that embedded principle is called tenant. So the interesting scenario here is that you're allocating a small, you know, a subset of, you know, the alter page. The landlord has allocated some of its own display space to another principle and rent it out. It's like renting it out. And that window actually is shared by, it's kind of, there are two principles involved in that display, you know, that window. You know, there's the things like how big should this window be, mm-hmm. and who should be drawing inside of it, who can navigate it. And actually, it's a shared, sometimes when this is shared, then we need to perform access control on, you know, which principal can do what, right? So actually, in our paper, we give a, you know, nice table describing, you know, the right kind of policies.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the landlord should be in complete control where this window is and how big it is. Consider, if the landlord doesn't have this control, the tenant would be able to place his window at arbitrary places,
mm-hmm.
and can overdraw landlord's, you know, landlord's spaces, and that would be undesirable. That can lead to attacks, right? On the other hand, the area within the window, like when you rent a room out, the landlord is not supposed to just go in there and look into your drawers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the
or
content...
Or open your mail.
Or
that's
open your
good.
Mail.
Yes.
And that really belongs to the tenant.
Yes.
then in our browser, we actually want to make sure that only the tenant are able to draw this area.
But then how, so you first said, like, you know, that one of the restrictions was the size. So how can the landlord now kind of, you know, check that the size is kind of, you know, that maybe there's a minimum size that the kind of, you know, the tenant doesn't draw like a one pixel kind of, you know, thing, and without looking at, you know, what the tenant is doing.
The landlord, once you give the display space to the tenant, you're basically saying, you know, you live there, and you take control of the space and the stuff in it, and everything in there will belong to you. But the landlord is not able to kind of, you know, oversee your life.
Okay.
So this doesn't solve the problem of going to a rogue site, right?
No, that's, it does not.
It's implicit in your action. We'll
right.
just run
it
in an
not.
Enclosed area.
Right.
Okay, so there's certain things that the landlord then cannot check, like, you know, that there's a minimum size of something that's drawn in there, or...
No, the landlord cannot control what
okay.
this principal is doing, and the fact that the landlord included it, it maybe because it wanted to be part of its own service provision.
Okay.
Interesting.
So there are other aspects, you know, so who can draw it? So only the tenant should be able to draw within that
mm-hmm.
rented out area. But there's also, you know, who gets to, you know, decide who the next tenant is. You know, basically it's about the navigation of that window. You know, can the landlord navigate it? I think so. Yeah, I think that would be reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually our policy. because I can run into another person. Can the tenant also navigate it? Yes, because I may need to navigate it just within my own site or navigate it to somewhere else, and that's also reasonable. But on the other hand, we don't want the landlord to know where the tenant has been.
Has been to.
That navigation history should be private to the tenant, in the tenant's navigation. So for example, our policy there is that, you know, both tenant and the landlord can write to, can allow the navigation, but it cannot read where this window is going, because the tenant may be navigating the window as well, and we don't want that navigation history to be exposed to the landlord. So there are a lot of this kind of intricacies in the web application that does not exist in web applications. So some of these policies that we talk about, and some of them are kind of vaguely exist in today's browsers, and they're, you know, realized all over the places in the browser code. But in our design, the key design principle we have followed is that we want to have a multi-principle operating system based on construction for our browser. What that really means is the operating system is the only place that exclusively, it's the exclusive place that manages the protection and resources.
And so these policies, are they kind of, you know, can you change them? It's like, can I say I want to have like now an application where, you know, the rules are kind of slightly different, or are these kind of baked in? These are, you know, the kind of, you know, the axioms of your system.
For example, those policies that I talked about, those are the security policies that we have chosen for our browser, and they live inside our, you know, browser kernel, which is browser-based operating system. So browser kernel is the place, is the only place in our browser that makes all the security decisions, unlike all previous browsers.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so how is this implemented? So how do you kind of, you know, how did you write kind of, you know, when you have these policies, you know, is this, did you implement this on top of IE8, or, you know, did you kind of, you know, write this from scratch?
Our experience that is, it's actually quite possible to, construct, you know, using all existing, code and to construct an architecture like this. So what we did is basically we instrumented a Trident, which is the render engine for IE. We use IE7 Trident. So what we did is basically instrument a Trident instance. So that whenever it issues network requests, whenever it does display, it always goes through our browser kernel. And then there's a one instance of Trident per web principle instance. So that's the basic implementation strategy that we have.
So that's an interesting question. So why do you need like a separate instance of Trident?
Yes.
Because if you're intercepting, you could, you know, you're kind of virtualizing the kind of, you know, the rendering engine. So couldn't you kind of, you know, then have like just one
We want to have a process isolation boundary across the website principles. So each website principle, they run in a separate protection domains, and our realization of that protection domain is to use restricted operating system process.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and if they share a Trident instance, that means multiple principles will have a lot of sharing. That's not what we want.
Okay.
And so that's actually, yeah. Go ahead.
Basically, a bug in one site's rendering engine or a crash will not bring down other website principles.
Yes.
Main reason.
Yeah. Exactly.
But from a scalability point of view, I mean, that doesn't seem like this is research, but in reality, throwing up a whole instance of Trident per, say you have a mashup of 30 sites or 30 principles, which in the future will, you know, that's not hard to believe. How's that going to work from a...
Well, I think you will have a larger memory footprint, for sure. I think actually a lot of things perhaps can be streamlined in the Trident.
Sure.
In Trident, and just if for this kind of purpose.
But just to be clear, because we don't want Mary Jo Foley to write about this, You guys actually used, and that's no offense, Mary Jo, she knows what I'm saying. You used what was available to you, and that's why you picked IE7 Trident engine. There's nothing, these are not the droids you're looking for. There's nowhere to go with this from a press kind of reality. Anyway, I just had to throw that in. Now I don't have to edit. Thank you. Cool.
Eric?
Yeah. So, it's very interesting that, like, this kind of, like, interception, right? You know, that seems to be kind of, you know, a very common technique. I don't know if you guys have heard of the web sandbox where...
Yeah, absolutely.
Where it's kind of also a kind of similar thing. And, of course, like, all the virtualization that people are doing on the kind of...
Web sandbox actually descended from our earlier project called Browser Shield Project, that which we did in summer 2005 and we published a paper on that in the OSDI 2006. Then actually I'm really pleased that, you know, LiveLab and Scott Essek and Drigos, they have picked up the browser shoot and turned it into a web sandbox and released it to the open source community. Mm-hmm. I think that's really exciting. Mm-hmm. That was our prior work.
Great. That's kind of nice to see that there's like a stream from, you know, research ideas to the real world. So are there any places, other places where you're kind of using this idea of kind of, you know, sandboxing via interception? I'm just here because I'm kind of fascinated by that thing, right? It's like, you know, it's the ultimate idea of like having an indirection somewhere and then, you know... You can have
so actually here, I think the key idea, I think, is really about constructing a browser as a multi-principle operating system. You know, I think for the first time that we finally have, you know, considered building a browser as a multi-principle operating system. The operating system has been around for decades. You know? There's been decades of gems of research. Mm-hmm. Whether it's research as well as in the practical systems out there, and unfortunately that area has never been well applied in the browser space. And actually, this is, in my opinion, is long overdue. And I think I'm glad that we're doing it right now.
So you talked about a little bit about, like, you know, the kind of real state of the screen. But I would guess that if you look at, like, you know, other resources, like, you know, computation, you want to have, like, similar things where, you know, you want to kind of make sure that this thing doesn't kind of, you know, suck up all the CPU time or
absolutely.
All the memory. So
yes.
You kind of...
We have tackled all aspects of the problem.
Okay.
Alex and I have focused on, you know, a lot of what you just said. But since we have not yet disclosed that in our patent, so I will withhold... for this interview.
No problem.
These are not the droids you're looking for.
So can I ask a question?
Stay tuned, and we will have a paper released.
Okay.
We'll come back pretty soon.
Yeah. We'll come back.
So you had a question?
I had a question because I'm an operating system dude. I mean, I'm really, really interested in operating systems. And it seems like they're, you know, if you look at browsers today, they kind of are sort of like Windows 95 type operating system. There's no kernel. Anything can crash it and blue screen it.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys are going more for the microkernel or sort of the NT model, if you will, with having the kernel. My question is, can a principal run code inside of your kernel?
No.
Beautiful. Thank you. Had to ask. I mean, I hear OS, I think blue screen. I mean, if you think about it, like a driver model,
thing is that browser kernel is the place that offers the protection for all the principals.
Okay.
And it offers all the resource management. It actually makes all the security decisions.
And so you're guaranteeing...
There's no security decision that's being made in the principal space. In the principal space, actually today's, you know, what we have, you know, the HTML parser, JavaScript engine, they all run in the principal space, and they are not part of our browser kernel at all. So the browser kernel is relatively simple.
Understood. It only deals with...
And the same is true for plugins. So
great point.
Well, that would be my next question. Yes, what about plugins? Yes.
So basically, I mean, all the plugins obey the same policies. So today, plugins have direct access to the underlying operating system. They can do whatever they want to. And you trust the plugin to implement security for you. In our model, all of the plugins go through the browser kernel for any resource access or resource management. So something like Flash will not be able to just compromise your system. So all of the plugins are also sandboxed.
And so another question is like, you know, how do plugins, because if you isolate everything completely, then you don't get like, you know, then the whole idea of mashups or like that doesn't work, right? So there must be some communication between the components. So how do you deal with that?
IPC. And I mean, the operating system has long had the answer for that. That's the inter-process communication. We allow inter-process communication. We allow cross-principal communications. And in fact, in our prior work, Mashup OS, we proposed cross-principal communications and different protection abstraction, communication abstractions that we ought to support. So Mashup can take leverage those cross-principal communications, IPC kind of communications to realize your mashups.
Okay, so here's an interesting, something that kind of puzzles me. So you in the beginning you said there's the kind of single origin restriction, right? But now suppose I have two principles running and they can communicate. So how does that kind of match with the, because now they can kind of share information. So in some sense,
it's message passing.
Okay.
It's message passing, and you send a message to the other principal, and the other principal can reply or decline to reply. So they can implement the service specific access control, for example. So, you know, they can, you know, have authentication built into their own service logic, and depending on who's sending me this message, and of course that's going to be built up on top of the message passing layer, and then you can.
And do you have any mechanism like, you know, universal plug and play or something where a plugin can say, hey, here I am, you know, and because how does one plugin discover another one? That's kind of basically, you know.
How does one plugin discover another?
Yes, because, you know, like, you know, suppose I have, like, my weather widget. Mm-hmm. Now I want to kind of, you know, some other plugin or some other, might want to kind of, you know, communicate with that, but how does it know that there's a weather kind of widget, you know,
see,
on the page?
Right, so,
they can always go through the root page, which knows exactly how the widgets are composed.
To the what page? Sure.
Through the embedding page, the root page that embedded the two gadgets. So.
Okay, and is there a protocol for that? So can I ask the page, you know, which things are loaded or...
So right now, in HTML5, there is already a proposal. I believe that's being implemented. That's actually has already been part of both IE8 and Firefox 3, which is something called post message. Basically, you will have a list of frames on, you know, the people that you're able to communicate with, and those are... you can send those frames, the messages.
And so to kind of, you know, I like to drill down a little bit more in the kind of, you know, the communication mechanism. So how do the processes communicate? Like, you know, do you send strings around like in other kind of proposals where people
it's
have
a data
like,
only communication.
Okay, and that's strings, or, you know, what at what level do these things communicate, or do they like, is it like PowerShell where you send .NET objects, or maybe DOM,
no.
or like higher level things?
It's going to be like primitive types and or like string based, basically value data, data only message passing.
Sure. I mean, I data only, but kind of what kind of data? So it's like only primitive strings, integers. So there's.
You can encode any data you want.
Yeah.
You can encode an image and a string.
Of sure, everything can be encoded, right? But you know, now, you know, it's like that. That was when we did the kind of, you know, the PowerShell interview. That was there very interesting. That they make that really easy, where you can compose things, where you know, you can, you know. Transmit .NET objects, and they will take care of, like, you know, whatever, you know, if it has to go via strings, they will do it for you. So now you get like a very nice composition at the high level where, you know, you don't have to deal with it.
You can build up a software layer on top of it. I believe, don't quote on me on this, but I think in our prototype, we just have something that's very simple, like a string-based passing across the principles. I think that's very similar to
Considering what web applications pass around today, which is, I mean, exactly that. Use JSON or something like that.
Well, but again, JSON is already has kind of, you know, a little bit more structure than strings.
I think it's possible for anyone to impose additional layers on top of the very primitive message passing layer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because and I'm kind of kind of grilling you a little bit here, because like if you look now, like for example with JSON, now people have to go, oh my God, you know, how do I parse this? Oh well, I do an eval, right? Which is kind of
Do that.
Exactly. Yes. So I think there's also a little bit of like making it putting people on the right path, to kind of to do these things.
I think there's definitely a significant amount of work that needs to be done for web development toolkit. What we have done is mostly kind of constructing the browser as an operating system. I think we haven't done the work about a software development kit for the front end development as well as back end development. I think that's very much in need. I think there are already some efforts out there. For example, Azure is addressing some of the back-end scalability and such. Mm-hmm. And there are also some other well-known ones like Ruby on Rails, and that's also for back-end software development. There is also some front-end kind of development. I feel that that's an area that still needs a lot of work.
And so to talk a little bit more about like the programming model, so is JavaScript still the kind of language to program like these browser applications, or are you proposing something else that has like types where from the types you can derive certain properties, or what is your opinion about that?
Well, I can talk about my opinion, Alex can talk about
his. Okay, sure. It would be nice if you have opposing opinions.
Yes.
I think browser platform right now is all encompassing. And, we have various plugins. We have Silverlight. We have Flash.
ActiveX.
All kinds of ActiveX, right? Mm-hmm. And you can enable all kinds of content. There's also even work talking about whether both Microsoft and Google have work talking about, having native applications directly conforming with the browser platform, right? So when I talk about what's the web platform, and I think it's really all-encompassing. And in our project here, we are not embracing one programming model versus another. My personal opinion is that JavaScript is here to stay, and it will continue to improve, and it will be getting better and better, and I think there will be interesting program model emerging out of it. For example, some of our previous experience in Browser Shield and Web Sandbox, I think there will be kind of new JavaScript programming model coming out of those kind of things, like Kaha and Add Save, this kind of one. But on the other hand, there's also there's definitely a developer base for Flash. There will be increasing number of developers for Silverlight, and as well as many other ActiveX control that, or any browser plugins that you can think of. So I think that at least for our project's purpose, the key is not to embrace one programming model versus another, but rather to have a language-independent operating system that's tailored for the web applications. That's tailored for the web security model.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So
I agree. Yeah.
But in their model, I mean, arguably, you guys really shouldn't care about the user mode sort of programming model, because you're interested in principles, security, such that if I want to write something in C++, which I personally think is insane in a web page, what I would ask, though, is if I write, a low-level ActiveX plugin, can I reach around behind the kernel?
No.
No.
Totally isolated from doing that. You're guaranteeing that.
Plugins in our architecture live in the principal space.
Perfect.
So
good,
but which is great, right? Because, why? I mean, I don't think it's that ridiculous to write C++ things, because I mean, again, if you want to do kind of, like have a native app like games or things like that, I want to run them in the browser.
But just as C++ code?
Yes, why not? I mean, there's like millions of people that write C++.
Fine. So people have talked about.
Yeah.
For example,
we should give them the freedom to use.
Fair enough. I just think it's kind of crazy, man.
Well, I agree. I think it is crazy. But
right on.
Some of the previous research work Some of them are actually quite practical, like Zach, Microsoft Research's Zach, and Google's native client. They're exactly addressing the problem. There's so much legacy desktop applications. And it would be nice for them to also enjoy the software distribution model of web services. And so that corresponding technology develops so that they can be also enjoying this kind of distribution model, but they're contained. And all of those will live in a principal space in our architecture.
Okay, so
they're basically essentially the, you know, the native code plugin model. We encompass all that.
Okay, so to kind of, you know, to add to Charles' question of, like, you know, kind of, you know, reaching behind. So what, when we talked about, like, you know, the kind of, you know, the UI surface. So what if I have a native app that uses, like, you know, it doesn't use Trident to render? So how would that kind of work?
Then it has to do its own rendering. It basically has to do. Basically, what we offer from the browser kernel is a set of system calls to access system resources, and you can be native code, you can be Trident, you can be a plugin.
But how can you then still control, you know, where the kind of, you know, that plugin renders if that's kind of completely native code and it just draws, you know, on?
No, it has to go through our browser kernel for display.
Okay, so it has to go through your APIs for display.
Our browser kernel manages all resources, including the display.
Okay.
So even in the process, if I look if I want to figure out what's in a process explorer, I'm only going to see one exe. It's going to be called gazelle.exe. I'm pretending like this is really something real. What you're telling me is that everything that runs inside of that single exe is controlled by your principal model. And so what Eric is sort of asking is, like, what if I mean, an EXE running on Windows can pretty much do anything.
Right? Right.
So assuming it's running as administrator.
Yeah.
So what's going to stop me from being a good developer, and most C++ developers are, not all.
So that's the use of a restricted operating system process. The operating system process is restricted. Actually, earlier work has demonstrated that it's possible to constrain sandbox the process. So that it can only issue the system calls to our browser kernel. Only it can use our browser kernel system calls.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And so here's, like, you know, again, you know, you don't have to answer, but you have, like, a fixed set of system calls that you have to go through. Did you kind of use any kind of, you know, formal methods or something to kind of prove properties about this, you know, because, you know, like, you know, because we're here in research, right, where people are doing, like, PECs and, you know, and
chess
that was what I'm looking for, and, you know, spec sharp and so on. So,
yeah, that's great. I mean, it's very good, Eric, and you know, a lot of interesting work here in Microsoft Research. I think we're indeed very interested in being able to more formally verify the security properties of our browser kernel, especially because all the security decisions, security policies are realized there.
Exactly.
That's our future work. Actually, we are very interested in exploring using some of, like, spec sharp this kind of work to explore whether how that can be applied to verify browser security policies. Maybe I shouldn't talk too much about that,
since we want to
invent more there.
Yes.
Fine, that's okay.
We won't. That's
fine, though.
Because I trust the machine more than the human, so
absolutely.
The more kind of, you know, we can have machine check things, that's the better it is.
I agree.
Yep. So, and now, of course, you know, now I should kind of, you know, pretend that I'm kind of, you know, a real kind of practical guy. So what about performance? So is this, you know, does this, do I pay a lot to kind of get all the security, or?
I mean, in our current research prototype, and for a research prototype, and we have only this much development resource.
Yeah. Right here,
so
there's your development
resource
right there.
Our research prototype, of course, is highly unoptimized, and the way that we instrument the Trident is through layers of interposition code. And so there is.
So are you using
PTours?
No,
actually, we use the.
Which is another Microsoft
control,
Research thing.
The web control wrapper in C Sharp. Our browser cron actually is largely implemented in C Sharp.
Okay.
Wow.
And but of course, it also uses a lot of other .NET classes which are native. So we can. It's not entirely a managed code. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's entirely managed code, but our implementation are all C Sharp implementations. So we used a web browser control actually in the principal space and instrumented that web browser control to issue system calls to our browser kernel. So that implementation alone it has a lot of overhead. Mm-hmm. I think mostly due to the artifact of this prototype. I think the right implementation is to directly go into the Trident and have a direct invocation to our browsers rather than going through layers of interposition, whether it's the C Sharp interop layer or the COM interop layer.
So just to be concrete, so you took the kind of, you know, that control and then kind of re-implemented all the calls to kind of, you know, be intercepted? Okay. Yeah.
Just to prove, like, sort of,
yes.
You know, your point.
Yeah, right now it's just we want to see the feasibility
of
constructing this this kind of architecture. That's
a feature that a lot of people are asking for. It's like the kind of aspect-oriented kind of style where people really want to have a way to kind of, you know, intercept calls. So, I mean, it's a very useful concept. So I'm just curious how you did it. And
yeah. We don't have any inventions there. We just leveraged what's existing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So. Interesting.
And so how many kind of lines of C Sharp are we talking about for the whole thing?
Alex, do you remember that? Did we write that in the paper?
The browser kernel is pretty small.
Yeah, the browser kernel is about 5,000 lines of C Sharp code. Then a lot of code in the principal space is basically doing the instrumentation.
So are you finding that, I mean, back to sort of a higher level, you chose to use an operating system as your guiding architecture. Mm-hmm. Now, there could be other architectures you could have decided to play with. How's it working out for you? How's your experiment going?
Yeah.
Oh, I think this is the right browser architecture. I think, I hope all the browsers will embrace this kind of architecture.
Hmm.
Yeah. Of course, it raises some. It definitely adds more work for realizing compatibility. So there is no inherent compatibility problem in this kind of architecture. But making things compatible requires additional, for example, IPC costs because of how today's browsers operate and how many web services are authored with certain assumptions. So to be fully backward compatible, I think it needs work. but there's nothing inherently in this architecture that makes it incompatible.
So did you try out, like, you know, how many sites kind of would, you know, still work in your case? Like, how intrusive is this? Suppose that, you know, we would say, you know, all browsers kind of adopt this model. How much of the web would break?
Well, I think if you fully embrace compatibility, that means you need to do a lot of work.
Oh, but of course, you don't want to embrace all compatibility because there might be dangerous sites
exactly.
out there that you don't
exactly.
want to.
Exactly. In fact, in our work, in our technical reporting, in our work, we actually have decided a bunch of policies which we think we should, for the sake of security, right? We have used a bunch of security policies that may break some websites, but then we think the reason of breaking them is really because they really pose significant security threat. But nevertheless, I think for a production browser, you need to make this kind of trade-offs. And I think the interesting future work is to figure out, actually we have not done a very comprehensive backward compatibility evaluation on our set of security policies. But I think for a production browser, it needs to kind of make the trade-off on the backward compatibility and security. And so I guess that's all we can say. I think there's nothing inherent in this architecture that prevents compatibility. if you implement compatibility, you will be compatible with today's web. But I think it may be sensible to sacrifice some compatibility, maybe hopefully just a little bit compatibility for security.
And did you find any kind of, you know, actual websites that, you know, that would kind of, you know, that you can show that kind of, you know, are unsafe according to your policies? Those would be ones that would break. So, what I'm trying to get at is, like, you know, how big is that kind of fraction of websites that, you know, don't fall into your constraints?
We don't have the answer for you on that question. That involves a pretty complex evaluation,
yes, yeah.
Backward compatibility evaluation. But I can give you some example on some of the security policies we think it would be great to adopt those kind of security policies. Of course, we need to look at the compatibility cost more closely. For example, the document domain. So, for example, a website, let's say company.com, and it embeds another website, say book.company.com. So book.company.com can change its own identity to company.com so that it can communicate with company.com. So this is the existing practice,
mm-hmm.
And I think we think this is very dangerous. The reason is this completely violates the principle of least privilege. That is, whoever sets their identity to company.com, whoever has the ability of setting their identity to company.com, will be able to access all your content, all your
mm-hmm.
resources. And that's scary, I think. I think we're not alone on that opinion. But, you know, I do know that there are websites that use it, and if we disallow that, that would definitely bring those features. But so I think for a production browser, and I think you will need to, you may sometimes need to sacrifice security for compatibility as well. Another example, websites use HTTPS
mm-hmm.
so that they can have end-to-end security. Existing websites, they embed other HTTP kind of principles as well as, you know, scripts that's transmitted using HTTP.
Mm-hmm.
In our architecture, the HTTP, embedded HTTP principles, they render in a separate process. So they cannot interfere in the same address space. But of course, they would still interfere in the display, potentially. But a dangerous thing is if you have a script, and that script is HTTP, then that script will run as the principle of this enclosing page. So what that means is your enclosing page intends to have end-to-end security. That means even if there is a network attacker, then HTTPS can defeat that network attacker. But if you're incorporating an HTTP script, that completely, it's really at conflict with the intention of that website. So in our browser, and we made a decision that, you know, if it's a script, we deny it. You know, we will not retrieve that script, we will not render it, because it's going to be able to interfere with that principle at object, you know, at really those kind of levels.
But if the script was pointing to an HTTPS URL, it would be fine.
Yes.
With the same certificate
mm-hmm.
associated to
yes.
it.
So, you know, I just gave you some examples.
No, that's great.
I can't be sure, actually, we cannot be sure at this point whether we have made the reasonable decisions, but our decision so far in our research is basically we want to be as backward compatible as possible, but subject to security. And security comes first in our current design. But I think in a production version of browser, I think it's, of course, it has much more complex setting. In our setting, I think the background compatibility is definitely a very important factor.
Yes, yeah, that's because there's like lots of content out there, so you know you don't want
yeah.
to.
But nevertheless,
yeah.
I think what's again, maybe I already said this point many times. Our architecture is not inherently incompatible.
Yeah.
You can achieve all the compatibility that you would want.
But I have one question, because a lot of times hacking that happens to people just surfing the web happens because of a bug in user mode. And I'm using user mode, like, you know, because you're talking about kernel user mode. User mode, I'm thinking, is that's where things get rendered and computed and calculated. You're not doing anything in the kernel with JavaScript. That engine's running in user
mode.
That's right. So my point is, if there's a bug in user mode in the implementation on this architecture, your system's not going to really protect me if I'm able to, as a developer, exploit a buffer overrun and a user mode component running in that process and go and embed something on the real OS and just sit there and watch your keystrokes? Or are you going to protect me against that?
I will protect you against that.
I want to make that clear.
Thank you. Because you're in the principal space, that means you're in a separate operating system process. Actually, that's also a restricted process. So if there is any memory corruptions, and only that process is bad. Only that process is corrupted, not other process, not browser kernel, not your whole system.
Beautiful. So I can't, there's no way, like we were talking about, there's no way to get out of the kernel and do crazy things on the real OS, or on the, so basically on the real OS, I shouldn't say real.
The underlying operating system.
Yes. Because you're writing an OS.
So yes.
Say your task scheduler and all the other stuff you have is very primitive in comparison to, say, Windows. The kernel and Windows doing a, you know, scheduling tasks.
Actually, in
our
memory. Well, just maybe very briefly, I will not talk too much about that.
Okay.
But I think we can, in our work, we leverage a lot of the existing operating system mechanisms. And what we have done is mostly to tailor them for the web applications, to have a, you know, browser kernel that's an operating system tailored for the web applications.
Perfect. Well, let's not go any further. We can.
But I think, you know, now we're adding to the kind of, you know, we're getting to the space where, you know,
now we're going to get in trouble.
Exactly. There's too much speculation. So I think this is a great time to stop.
Totally.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is a lot of fun.
Yes.
Yeah. Very excellent job. Yeah. And you are quite PR savvy for Building 99 and happening.
Oh, really?
Very nice job. Well, you caught yourself a lot. We've gotten in trouble before. Nice to meet you. Congratulations.
Nice to meet you guys.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, see you next time.
Great job.